In the spring of 1791, George Washington was halfway through his first term as president of the brand new United States. The country ran from Vermont, its newest state, in the north, all the way down to the deep south of Savannah. And the country was trying to figure out what it was. Everything was new. And everything was being figured out for the first time. George Washington had determined 2 years earlier, at the outset of his presidency, in fact, that whoever took on this role, this big, huge job, would need to do the real hard work of uniting, of bringing people together to make sure that everyone is pulling the proverbial rope in the same direction. Doing that, though, meant leaving the relative comfort of the Northeast in Philadelphia, because Washington was a president for all Americans. The southern colonies at the time didn't nearly have the population that the Northeast Corridor did, but the people in Virginia, the Carolinas, and in Georgia needed to see and hear their new president. They needed to meet the man who would lead them in the early years of a new government, a new idea, and a new nation. George Washington, for the first and only time in his life, was heading south. Welcome to the Marked Podcast. Across Georgia, there's more than 2,000 historical markers that tell the story of a person, place, or an event from our state's past. And our digital video series explores a select few of those from Georgia's revolutionary history. And in this podcast, we're expanding on that with additional voices to help bring out the stories of these markers and the context of what they tell us about our state. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Marked, the podcast. I'm Andrew Iden, the executive producer of the Marked Project here at Georgia Public Broadcasting. George Washington only visited Georgia once, and it happened in the spring of 1791, just 2 years into his presidency. The Revolution was over, the Constitution was new, and the future of the United States was far from certain. Washington believed that if this new nation was going to survive, he needed to meet the people he served and see the country for himself. The story of his trip south in the spring of 1791 is often overlooked, though. And today we're going to spend some time talking about it, and the two people joining us are absolute authorities in every sense of the word. She is a professor emerita of history at Augusta University, where she is also the director of the university's Center for the Study of Georgia History. She has also served 2 terms as president of the Georgia Association of Historians, and has a PhD in history from the University of Georgia. Dr. Leanne Caldwell, hello.
Hello.
And he is a speaker, a writer, a broadcaster, and for 20 years has studied George Washington. And 10 years ago, he put that research on the page and quite literally wrote the book, George Washington's Southern Tour, available wherever books are sold. Warren Bingham joining us from North Carolina. Hello, how are you today?
Hi, Andrew. Great to be with you. Greetings from the Tar Heel State.
Well, thanks so much. I'm looking forward to talking to both of you about all things President Number One and sort of the particulars of his travel to the state of Georgia.
He was America's very first CEO. He packed his bags for a road trip to the Deep South. It was a gesture of unity and of leadership. And it also sent a clear message that the United States of America wasn't just ready to stand on its own, but that the office of the president reports to the people.
The place to start with this discussion, I imagine, and we'll start with you, Warren, and then Dr. Caldwell will come to you second. I'd like to start with talking about where America was in 1791, right? This is a couple of years into George Washington's presidency. And I think in order, before we get to the trip, we have to understand the backdrop of the nation, where the nation is systemically and sort of from an infrastructure standpoint, politically, all of that.
The 1770s and 1780s were tumultuous times in America and this part of North America. And the new United States was not especially united for much of that time. More and more, I think, but during this period of celebrating or commemorating America's 250th, we're hearing that there was a lot of civil strife, a lot of disagreement among folks, Americans at that time, about what we should be doing. Is this independence the right thing or not? It was not clear cut that everyone was a, quote, patriot against the Brits by any stretch. So you got through that. And then we had to, once we won the Revolution, we had to determine what sort of government we were going to have. And then so the Articles of Confederation, which many people have heard of and don't know much about, but that was what was put in place to govern us as a nation for a number of years. And then that didn't work very well. The states were too autonomous and there was very little federal control. And so then we had the Constitutional Convention, and that was controversial. And then even ratifying the Constitution, some close calls in some of the states. Virginia, one of the leading states, really barely ratified the Constitution, if I'm remembering that correctly. So Washington becoming the first president, and that was important because he was a kind of a unique, unifying figure. He was the hero of the Revolution. He presided over the Constitutional Convention. And so this was the guy that most people could accept. And he knew that. And so that's why he thought it was important to visit all the states during his first term as president. He wanted to, as others have said, to see and be seen, thinking that was one of the best things for the nation.
Well, the American Revolution had been over for about 10 years by that point, and he sort of embodied, for a lot of people, the American nation. He thought it was time for him to get out and come down to the southern states, where, believe it or not, even though he was a Virginian, he had never been south of Virginia. So he decided to come out and see North Carolina, South Carolina, and here in Georgia.
South of Virginia, and the further south you go, from Pennsylvania even, there are less and less and less citizens. A lot of people, half of them or more, depending upon where you're living and at what exact date, are enslaved or free blacks, whose opinions don't matter in the grand scheme of early American politics. But George Washington understands that it is important to connect North and South, especially Charleston and Savannah, because those are two cities that are very important to America's export game.
Georgia looked really different in 1791, right? And settlement was beginning to push inland, new land was opening to migration, and the state is really expanding rapidly beyond its coastal roots. So if you can, paint the picture for us on that, Dr. Caldwell.
Well, number one, the state went to the Mississippi River. So it was much bigger than it is today. But if you look at where people were settled, certainly along the coast, but Augusta had always been this little upcountry first fort and basically trading post with mainly the Cherokee further north and the creeks, both upper and lower creeks, to the west. And so there had been some settlement up the Savannah River. But in the time period we're looking at, there had been two major Indian cessions of land right before the Revolution, one in 1763 and one in 1773. And they moved that agreed upon boundary with the creeks a little bit further west and a little bit further north. So this opens up land, and we're going to see people beginning before, but certainly after the Revolution, pouring into these new lands. They could get land by headright grant prior to the Revolution, and then after the Revolution, we're also going to see former Revolutionary soldiers who basically are getting paid in land, moving into these areas.
And because the South doesn't have a lot in terms of population, it's kind of the wild country.
Traveling in the 18th century was probably worse than we even imagine it to be. Sitting on a horse hour after hour after hour, 20, 30 miles a day, day after day after day, with very few roads, even fewer roads that resemble anything like finished roads. Rain or snow throws everything into confusion. A tour like Washington's requires a great deal of logistical machinations and logistical organizing just to get everyone from point A to point B. During his trip, he was able to stay in what they considered close contact with Vice President John Adams.
You know, we have the backdrop of what the country sort of looks like and where it is politically and all of that. Now we have a little bit of understanding of where Georgia is geographically and the people in the state of Georgia. Can you walk me through, Warren, a little bit about when Washington makes the determination, this is a thing I have to do? Some of the reading that I've done is that he had said something to John Adams long before this decision was made about, at some point, this is something I need to do, the importance of seeing people. Walk me through the process of, like, the decision to make this trip, the laying out of the route, who, you know, what was sort of the nuts and bolts of all of that?
Sure. Yes, Washington had this notion right out of the gate. He wrote John Adams within a week or two of becoming the president, Adams being his vice president, and had a litany of things that he proposed or suggested that he thought that he, the president, might should do. And I think it was more of Washington being the strong figure that he was. I think it was more like he was just musing on paper and advising Adams that he was probably going to do these things, although I'm sure he valued Adams' opinion, but I never found any evidence of response on that particular letter. But among those things that Washington listed was that perhaps a tour of the states during congressional recesses would be good for the union of the country, and to see the principal features and meet the important people and see all the people and this sort of thing. And so sure enough, when Washington actually left Mount Vernon to become president, he was inaugurated in New York City, it became a festival all along the route. He was celebrated in each state and larger communities with all kinds of tributes and cannon salutes and bonfires going and people dressing in their finest, et cetera. That may have given him the idea, actually. I don't know. But that would be ultimately what would happen during all of his touring. So he had the notion right out of the gate. He sort of did the middle states as he traveled from Mount Vernon to New York. But then he would make a New England tour in 1789. And then he would make this southern tour in 1791. And back then, I think it was often only judges and preachers and politicians who were out traveling regularly and coming back home. Otherwise, most people that traveled were going somewhere and staying there. So those kind of gentlemen talked among themselves about best roads, where to cross water, where to stay, where not to stay, et cetera. And that's the kind of advice that Washington got was from the leaders in Philadelphia. And there were some maps back then, but roads were very uncertain, and you never knew what obstacles might be in them. And he allowed a lot of time. He knew it was too rough and long a trip for his wife, so she would not be going, and he would be escorted by, I believe it was two enslaved men, five paid staffers from his home in Philadelphia, and Major William Jackson, who was a Revolutionary War hero from South Carolina, from Charleston originally, but served in the North during the war. And he was Washington's secretary at the Constitutional Convention. So he was used to working with Washington. And most importantly, he was only in his early 30s and single. So Washington knew he could be away and free for months at a time.
So Washington believed that the presidency could not exist solely on paper, right? If Americans were going to trust this new government, this whole new concept, they're going to need to see it. And that means seeing him.
President Washington also isn't doing this trip solo. There's a whole group, their staff, including his secretary and right hand, Major William Jackson, a few horses, a couple of carriages. So wanting to avoid a deep South summer, the trip south from Philadelphia starts around 11 a.m. on March 21st, 1791.
he had an entourage of about 10 people. We know how presidents travel today with the security they have and the administrative staff that they have. He really didn't have any of that. He also traveled with one of his dogs, which he enjoyed.
Washington is an observer of everything around him. And as you travel by horseback hundreds and hundreds of miles, he sees a society that in some ways certainly resembles the cavalier nature of his home in Virginia. He observes what we come to know as Southern gentility.
People turned out for him. So although he's being led by leaders in the state, he also is seeing all of these ordinary citizens who are lining, you know, the roads as he comes into places. So he's seen by many, many people. But a lot of the people that he's going to see, both in Savannah, where he comes first, he comes over into Georgia from Perrysburg, South Carolina, across the Savannah River. And then in Augusta, a lot of them are people who were leaders in the American Revolution. For example, in Savannah, Lachlan McIntosh will be there. McIntosh was with Washington at Valley Forge. When he gets to Augusta, he'll be met by George Walton, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence from Georgia. And so these are people that he was familiar with and had, in many cases, already seen in person before he got here.
I spent some time reading his journals from this trip, and I couldn't help but notice, and Warren, I'll kind of lob this one to you, I couldn't help but notice that he did make multiple statements in his journals about the geography and the topography and sort of the way the land was. And then I thought, well, that makes perfect sense. He's a land surveyor, right? Like, this is what he knows. And so it was really kind of, it was interesting to me that he was noting that in his journals and like sort of laying out the land literally in his writing.
Well, Andrew, kudos for reading Washington's trip diary. It's not the most exciting read.
It took me a minute. I had to read it a few times to really process it. But yeah.
But yes, Washington constantly noted the vegetation and the soil and the condition of the land and the types of trees and the rivers and how deep they were, et cetera, because I guess it goes back to his founding as a surveyor back as a teen. Plus, he was a farmer and a soldier, and these are all important things if you're going to do that. So I guess that's a natural. He also, as Dr. Caldwell said, as he was going from Savannah to Augusta, he's going uphill and he's getting from the sandy soil into a mix. But he worried about his horses because the horses were the transportation, and he loved horses. But he was far from his home base, and he had been out a long time by the time he got to Georgia. So he wanted to keep these horses healthy. So he was, I think I'm reading between the lines, he was fretting about it was tougher on the horses going uphill and in loose soil than otherwise. So he was kind of happy when he got to the clay of the northern South Carolina, I think. So that was part of it too. But yeah, his diary, thank goodness he kept them, but he doesn't often share much about what goes on with who he talks to. He's much more into the geography and features of what he's seeing out the carriage window.
So he was an outdoorsman. He loved being outside. And of course, as a military person, he had studied terrain and topography. And so he was always interested in where cities were positioned and particularly how they might develop. That was another thing that happened on this tour. He was actually able to sort of see the country and understand better how it was going to expand in the coming years, which of course it did.
Washington wasn't just meeting politicians and military leaders. This visit actually becomes a social event to some degree. Dinners, dances, celebrations, and all kinds of toasts.
In the larger communities and cities on any of these trips, but particularly, I think, the Southern tour, it was very special, I believe, for Southerners who, I believe, the South did its part in the Revolution, and many argue it gets short shrift in the history for the last few hundred years as far as the role the South played. So I think it was important to the Southerners to actually have George Washington in their presence, maybe more so than even the other parts of the country. It was a party. in these larger places. It was a way of, celebration. The people didn't really get to celebrate as much back then as we know today. And so it was just a good reason to celebrate. And I make jokes about it, but I think there's some merit in it. The expression lighting up the town it probably comes from this era, because oftentimes it was literally a lighting of the town. Candles everywhere, torches everywhere, bonfires, you name it. And so lighting up the town to have fun. And then I do wonder, and this may relate to Chatham artillery punch, I think the expression getting blasted may have developed in this era, because they would have these toasts at some point in the evening, often at the end of a dinner, and they would drink at least 13 in many cases to commemorate each state. And then there were two or three extra on there, and there would be a cannon volley after each drink. And so I figured they're drunk by the end of the toasting, and the cannons are blasting. So getting blasted, there you go.
Each person would have 13 toasts and 13 drinks for each colony.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was to such things as to the commerce of America, to the agriculture of America, and so forth. Until they run out of things, I'm not sure they could get much past 15. So that was kind of where that halted. But it was often 13 plus 1 to 3 for good measure.
Like any VIP visitor, the president was wined and dined too. And some of that took place right behind me, which was once the site of a place called Brown's Coffee House, a Savannah staple in those days that was later torn down in 1889.
The city's elite spent time with him nearly 24/7, it seemed, dancing at feasts. And George Washington has always been known to love dancing with the finer sort. General Nathaniel Greene's wife, Katie, who lived in Georgia after the war, was a favorite of his. He loved dancing with her, and he loved flirting with women, from Abigail Adams all the way down to Eliza Hamilton to Katie Littlefield Greene.
One of the interesting challenges that Washington faces, right, is that the nation's first president has no roadmap. Every decision he makes has the potential to become a precedent for those who will follow him.
Right. Even to the point of saying two terms is enough. It wasn't put into the Constitution until after Franklin Roosevelt's election. But that precedent was followed all the way up to that point. And so I think he was very aware that he is setting precedent. And, we forget what an experiment this was. Here we are 250 years later, and we think, it was clear all along. And to many people, it wasn't clear all along. It wasn't even clear to European countries, of course, that this little struggling republic would end up surviving. And so these early days, I think, are so important in getting things on a firm foundation, getting trade going, getting the economy up and going in different ways in various places, depending on what their geographies were. Also, a very important thing at this time period is they had a sense that education was going to be important, because if you're not training people from birth to be a king, or training people to be in the House of Lords, if senators and people like that are going to simply come from your population, then you have to have an educated group of people. And if a lot of ordinary people are going to be voting, they need to be at least somewhat educated as well to make intelligent decisions about things.
Getting a view of him for Georgians must have been beyond electrifying, beyond gratifying. I don't think we could actually imagine what that must have felt like to Georgians, because he is bringing to them not only his celebrity status and someone that we don't just recognize as being important, we know that he is at the core this honest guy who believes in republicanism, meaning representative government, which is new. It is new and it's scary. But for the middling and lower classes, he had to have come across as something of a godsend, someone that is not just accepting of us as being part of this nation, but is willing to grant us or to embrace us as part of the body politic. And that's the first time, certainly in American history, but really world history. This is not something that is common, and he is at the head of it.
One of the things that's interesting about this visit, I think, is that it's not just simply ceremonial. You know, some of those observations he makes during the trip will have lasting consequences for Georgia long after he returns home to Virginia.
A lot of people stayed at boarding houses or inns that were often run by widowed women. It was one of the things a widow could do that was acceptable to support herself. And that, we think, is the case here in Augusta. He stayed in a boarding house on Broad Street that Ed Cashin, who was a very well-known Georgia historian, believed was Mrs. Dixon's boarding house. So other travelers would have stayed in those kind of places, and I'm sure Savannah had them as well. One interesting thing that I thought we might bring up is there are a couple of things that happen later as a result of Washington's tour through Georgia. Some of the people that met him in Savannah were Habershams, in particular Joseph Habersham, who Washington later appointed to be the postmaster of the United States. In Augusta, he decided, he went up to the fall line, saw the rapids, and he decided that Augusta would be a good place for an arsenal. In a day where you couldn't move cannon and other kinds of military equipment around very easily, having arsenals placed at strategic places in case you needed to defend yourself at some point, as they found out they did in the War of 1812 later, would be a way of having more access to weapons and things that they might need. And so in 1793, the governor of Georgia got a letter from Henry Knox that Washington had recommended that there should be an arsenal in Augusta. Well, that didn't happen immediately, but after the War of 1812, when they decided they better get some arsenals in the South, Augusta did get an arsenal built on the river, just as Washington had originally said. It would later move a few years later. They found out being on the river in the summer was not the healthiest place to be. People got fevers that they thought they were getting from vapors and miasmas from the river. Now we know it was from mosquitoes. But they moved it up on the hill above Augusta. And now the Somerville campus of Augusta State of Augusta University is there.
Do you both think, or not, that he accomplished with, you know, this trip what he set out to do? And what is sort of, you know, 250 years later, what is the legacy of that brief period of spring of 1791 and his trip to Georgia and throughout the South?
Well, let me say that Washington felt it was successful. I think it's a little hard to measure it, Dr. Caldwell, but I guess it was successful in the sense that, hey, one, it was a heck of a trip logistically, as Andrew points out, and the miles and doing it without any significant accident and pulling it off, et cetera, and being present before all those Americans and all those communities in the southern states. That was something. He also, in meeting with the leaders in all these larger communities, no one was pushing back on George Washington. So he was there promoting the new Constitution, the new government under it. Also, we hadn't mentioned this, but Congress had just passed the first tax, a tax on domestic distilled liquor. And so he was having to deal with that, too, and having private discussions. Now, this was a different era. You know, he didn't go stand on a stump and talk about why this tax is important. These were conversations over dinner, one-on-one or with small groups, and so forth. He again, was not getting much pushback. And this is the sort of thing he would write in his diary and letters later, that this was all favorable. So as contentious as things had been for nearly two decades, you got to feel like it was a good thing for the country and helping unite it at the time. But Washington was probably the only person that could do that. What do you think, Dr. Caldwell?
I think that's probably right. And I also wonder, it's hard to know, what impact it had on him.
Yes.
As he goes back for these last years. Now he has seen the magnificent diversity, both geographically and economically and demographically, of the country that he is governing. And so I can't help but think it must have had some impact on him to know what this country was and what potential the country might have. So I think it probably goes both ways. It certainly had impact on the people here, but impact on him as well. And it's interesting to think about that. It's almost like Jefferson deciding we need to know what's in the Louisiana Purchase. So we're going to have to send some explorers to find out. In a way, for Washington, he's exploring his new country to get a better picture of what it is. And he had these friends here. As Warren pointed out, he stopped at Katy Green's Mulberry Grove, which had belonged to a loyalist, Lachlan McGillivray, who had an Indian trading post here in Augusta, and whose son, he had an Indian wife in the Creek Nation, and they had a son named Alexander McGillivray. And in 1790, Washington had gotten Alexander McGillivray to come to New York, where they signed the Treaty of New York that gave up from the Indian ceded land all the way to the Oconee River. And there had been some kind of grumbling in Georgia. Well, why didn't he get it all the way further in, you know, get it closer to the middle of Georgia? And so by showing up, in a way, he's able to kind of put down whatever grumbling may have been going on underneath. So I think it probably had that effect as well.
George Washington spent only a short time in Georgia, but the trip was about much more than a visit. It was an effort to connect a fragile new nation, to build trust in a new government, and to show Americans that the presidency belonged to the entire country. More than two centuries later, presidents still travel the country, trying to accomplish many of these same goals. Marked the Podcast is written and hosted by me, Andrew Iden, and produced and edited by the GPB podcast team, Jeremy Powell, Miranda Hawkins, and Mark Davenport. Additional voice work provided by Andrew Howard. And Sandy Malcolm is the Senior Vice President of Content.